Six Music.
BBC Radio. Six Music Documentaries.
Morning. Bright windows open. Let in. What's so terrifying? Summer is as faded as a long cicada call. Memories so bright, I got a squint just to recall. Regret the words I've bitten. More than the ones I ever said.
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time on Six Music. This is the series where you meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shape their lives and their careers. Today's guest is a real artist, like Bowie or David Byrne or Kate Bush, someone whose work is comprised of totally different, inseparable elements: performance, production, dance, film, design, photography, all of which go up to make a complete world within which her music exists. An incredible guitarist and a deeply original lyricist, she produces albums of beautifully wrought, often very personal and sonically fascinating albums, each one more impressive than the last. Not least her most recent record, the brilliant Mass Seduction. My guest on the First Time this week is Annie Clark, maybe best known as St. Vincent.
Prince Johnny, you're kind but you're not.
Here we talk about Annie's formative musical influences and her earliest performances and recordings. We discuss her passion for Pina Bausch and David Byrne and the choreographic link between the two of them. We also talk about her thoughts on the nature and influence of fame. And we have what may well be the most eclectic collection of music in any First Time show. John Coltrane, Michael Jackson, Stravinsky, John Denver, Nirvana, Steely Dan, there's a lot of Steely Dan, and even Norwegian death metal band Mayhem. But I started by asking Annie, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time she was aware of music?
The first time I was aware of music was probably Michael Jackson, because we had a tape player with, I guess it would have been Thriller. And it just kind of lived in, you know, this tiny kind of cheap boombox or whatever. And I just remember listening to it, you know, side A would happen, and then I would flip over to side B, and then I would flip over to side A, like, ad nauseum. Like, I probably annoyed my siblings and family, but it was the most just intoxicating thing I'd ever experienced.
Was it a very musical environment that you grew up in when you were a kid?
No, I wouldn't. I mean, not particularly. You know, I had older siblings, and so Madonna and Michael Jackson and that kind of, you know, big pop stuff loomed large. George Michael. But and my uncle was a guitar player, and he was gone on tour for all of my growing up. So it was sort of like he was kind of like a mythical figure. But there wasn't a whole lot of music. My mom liked John Denver, and he had a song called My Life Is So Good.
Life is so good. Life is so good these days. Life is so good these days. Life is so good.
And that was those were the lyrics, and he was like, my life is so good, my life is so good these days, life is so good these days, my life is so good.
Good these days, life is so good these days, life is so good.
And even as a child, that song used to send me into a violent rage.
Life is so good, life is so good.
What about the first single that you owned, the first piece of music that you kind of held in your hands that was yours, that didn't belong to a sibling, that didn't belong to anybody else, that you chose?
Yeah, the first record that I chose that I bought with my own money was kind of prophetic. It was a Tripping Daisy record called I'm an Elastic Firecracker.
Okay.
Yeah, and then I ended up playing in a band with the remaining members of Tripping Daisy when they formed the Polyphonic Spree many years later. So it was prophetic, I'd say. Very good record. It really holds up. I listened to it not that long ago.
I got a girl who lives with me. I got a girl, she smells so sweetly. I got a girl, she loves her dog. Liar.
Another first. Let's do the first concert you went to, the first gig you went to.
Well, I will say I have two answers to this.
Go.
Because the first one I do not remember. The first gig, I'm told, was going to see Bobby McFerrin of Don't Worry, Be Happy fame.
Here's a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry, be happy.
And the Cosby Show was massive, obviously. It was the 80s. And I remember being so disappointed to find out that I had fallen asleep, because I was a child, when Bill Cosby got up and did an impromptu set.
Okay.
And it was not the first time I was in a room with Bill Cosby. He actually gave the commencement address at my college, and I got to go up and shake his hand and remember, you know,
yeah,
giving him some fond, you're such an inspiration, thank you. I mean, he wasn't an inspiration then, we just didn't know it, so.
Yeah.
But then the first concert that I was, like, awake for, I guess, would have been Steely Dan Tour 94, where they came back and did a whole rendition of their hits, you know, of which there are many.
Yeah, you've been on record as describing yourself as a Steely Dan completist. You kind of know everything musically that there is. What is it about them that you love so much? Is it just because it was there in your childhood and seeped its way into your DNA, or does it kind of chime with you in a way that other music doesn't?
I mean, I still will listen to Steely Dan and
they're
love
great.
It. It's really hard to know what is in you, because it just gets in your DNA when you're so young, and hard to, and what is, like, truly truly something you would have loved if you were, you know, older or more discerning, but it's also irrelevant, you know what I mean? I love Steely Dan. I will always love Steely Dan.
Which Dan track should we play at this juncture? What should we drop in?
Which Steely Dan song?
Yeah.
Okay, how about sorry, I'm, I have to sing the solo to get to what the words are. What is that song?
Things we'd have to play it now, because we can just play that.
It's on Can't Buy a Thrill.
I'll find it.
Yeah.
Don't worry, I'll find it.
Oh, Fire in the Hole. That's the Steely Dan song.
Yes.
I love to run out now. There's no way left. Yeah, it's a great song.
Good.
Great solo.
I'd love to run out now. There's no way left to turn. No. With a cough, I shake it off and walk around my yellow stride. Should I hide or eat my pride or wait until it's good and right? My life is boiling over. It's happened once before. I wish someone would open up the door. Don't you know there's fire in the hole and nothing left to burn? I'd love to run out now. There's no way left to turn.
Mm-hmm. When was the first time that you kind of realised you had a propensity for music, a kind of, when you realised it was something that you could create?
I think the first time was when I had a guitar when I was 12, and I was obsessed with Nirvana and Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and all that stuff, and I went to a guitar teacher and he taught me, how to play Smells Like Teen Spirit, and I was like, oh. I mean, it still was magic, but the idea that, like, I could have like a little toe in that magic, like I could kind of recreate it.
Yeah.
That was just like the most alive I'd probably ever felt to that point.
Just those four chords, and look, you can play that song.
Yeah, I still can play it.
First live performance, first performance that you did as a musician, maybe kind of the first professional walking on stage and playing for other people. What was that?
Yeah, I was 15, and there was a bar downtown that my guitar teacher would frequent, a place called Deep Drinks.
Deep Drinks?
I had learned Jimi Hendrix's The Wind Cries Mary, and I performed it with my guitar teacher's band, and it was this funny little club where the stage was actually probably on a balcony about 20 feet above the actual like bar and quote unquote audience area. It was really, but it was very sweet.
After all the jets are in the boxes and the clowns have all gone to bed, you can hear staggering on down the street, footprints dressed in red, and the wind whispers merrily.
I remember feeling like it was incredibly important, you know. And then I think after that, there were a lot of gigs. Because, in high school bands, you're terrible, so the only place you can really get gigs is, like, at the kind of Christian club. I played this... we would play at this Christian club downtown, which, obviously, there was no alcohol and nothing fun about it. But I was just reminded the other day that I did a lot of Tool covers at this Christian
club. At a Christian gig.
Yeah. Yep. Jesus, won't you whistle? It's just like, what? Okay. They let me do it.
I mean, did you click with live performance? That's a terrible phrase. Did you enjoy performing live early on? Was it something you wanted to do or something you felt like you kind of had to do? Which one was it?
I think I loved to do it, but I was also really scared of doing it. My friend says that the best performers are people who don't really want to be on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And I would kind of agree with that. And you know, it's I think it's probably part of the reason why Broadway musicals don't move me for the most part, except for Hamilton, which was lovely.
Yeah.
But because it's like people who are dying to be on stage and be at the center of attention and all that, that is very foreign. That's very foreign to me. It still takes some like summoning of courage and kind of psyching yourself up to go on stage. Yeah, and I would agree with her, not just in a self-serving way, but that it makes a better performer than someone who's like, look at me, I'm the star of the, you know, like, so.
I think that's very common in artists. There's a lot of, I mean, don't look at me, but can you look at me? But I'd rather you didn't look at me. But please look at me, don't look at
please
me.
Please look at me. Yeah, exactly. It's a really fraught psyche.
Rats Live on No Evil Star was 2003. Was that the very first release? Was that the first thing you released? The
EP
you
did? Oh, God. I mean, release is such an extravagant word for what that was. I printed up probably like 50 EPs and sold them out of a trunk of my car at gigs where I pretended to be my own agent in order to get the gigs. I mean,
hang on, wait, roll back. You pretended to be your own agent. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I wanted to play gigs, but I was too, it felt too egotistical and insane and uncomfortable to write people and be like, hi, you know, got a project. My name's Annie Clark. I'm really good. You know, it just felt so uncomfortable to do that. And so I thought, well, anybody who's like worth it would have representation. So I made up a fake booking agency, made up a fake name, and then emailed people from that pretending to be the agent of me.
Oh, what was your name? What was your fake agent name?
Well, you know, it was pretty close to my, I just took my middle name, which is Aaron.
Right.
And then I think it was Mann was my last, like M-A-N-N. I think that was it. And that worked swimmingly until there was a really stupid, embarrassing mishap at a Brooklyn club and a club, like bar. And the promoter, like... Barback was asking to speak to the agent. I was like, I don't know, I can't get a hold of her right now, but I so that was the end of that. But
that was the end of Aaron Mann. That's a shame.
Yeah, I had to kill her off.
Did you adopt like a much deeper voice or an accent when you were phoning venues up and stuff?
No, luckily, you know what? No, I didn't have to do any kind of different voice because no one would have put two and two together. No one would have been like, no one is pathetic enough to pretend to be their own agent to get a gig to play for six people who don't want to be there, you know?
Because, I mean, I was listening to...
But they underestimated me. They underestimated just how pathetic I was.
It's quite a sophisticated little collection of songs, that first EP, though.
I do remember being a big Anne Sexton fan at the time, which is why it is called what it is, because it's a Anne Sexton reference and a palindrome.
Thank you. This is The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and that was Bliss, the first track from St. Vincent's first ever release, a 2003 EP called Rats Live on No Evil Star, recorded while she was a student at the Berklee College of Music.
Six Music. BBC Radio Six Music.
Six Music.
Good.
Matt Everett, and this is The First Time on Six Music, where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Andy Clark, also known as St. Vincent. And that was Digital Witness, taken from St. Vincent's 2014 self-titled album. But this being the first time, I had to ask about Marry Me, the first album she released back in 2007. How do you feel about that record now? Are you kind of comfortable with it? If it's difficult to go back and listen to the first EP, do you...
You know what? I really don't know. I haven't listened to Marry Me in years. So
years?
Years and years. So I don't know. It's kind of one of those things that I'm so glad that the people who, you know, love it. And it's not any... You know, it's more... I'm certainly, like, proud of the effort that I put into... all things, I guess, that I've made, but it's kind of like looking at your high school yearbook photos or something. You go back and you're like, you have deep, like, compassion for that person at that time and go, oh, I remember what life was like then, and cool, this is like a, you know, little diorama of a moment in time, but I don't go, you know, I was really onto something there, I really should revert back to that or anything, you know, it's fine, it's sweet.
I guess there's two ways to look at it. Either do you listen to your own music? It's like, well, half of the idea would be, well, actually, I make the music that I can't hear. So, of course, I listen to it. That's why I make my music. And I enjoy listening to, you know, the stuff that I've created. That's why I did it. And the other half is like, yeah, well, you go home and go, I'm going to listen to my own records.
No, you know, which one of those two? I've certainly been, because where the real like insanity I think comes out is at photo shoots, because people, you know, if an artist is getting their picture taken for whatever, obviously people ask like, oh, is there any kind of music you want to hear to get in the mood? And I have heard a number of people want to put on their own records.
And no,
and I've had a lot of times people have asked me, like, oh, did you want to put on your own record? I'm like, God, no. That's the last thing I want to listen to at this photo shoot. Please don't. But what it indicates is that a lot of people say, yeah, put my shit on, you know, which is totally fine and rad.
Yeah.
That's just not my vibe. But, yeah, I don't go back necessarily and listen to... And go back and listen to my own stuff. I'm way more interested in whatever the next thing I'm gonna make is, and that's where my focus is, not necessarily in looking backwards.
Yeah. Because normally when we do this, we kind of ask people to pick musicians that have made music that they're passionate about. And you picked photographers and filmmakers as well, so thank you for doing that. But it's also kind of cool because it takes us off into some different kind of directions. Because Pina Bausch, the choreographer, was one of the people that you've chosen. Do you kind of draw a mental line these days between dance and or movement and your music? Because obviously it's something David Byrne does a lot.
I don't know. It's all that stuff feels very elemental in this way. And like it's all kind of made of the same things. It just takes on a different constitution. I watching Pina Bausch dances is like a deeply transcendent experience. And on the last tour, I did a lot of postmodern choreography. And one of the things I was basically directly ripping off / referencing was Pina Bausch doing the Rite of Spring and the part where the virgin dances herself to death. She does this really repetitive movement that it kind of looks like she's elbowing herself in the stomach and then quickly backing away and then elbowing herself in the stomach and da-da-da. And a lot of falling. So I was basically just doing my strange version of a couple Pina Bausch moves for the tour. I specifically wanted to do the virgin dancing herself to death and the falling. Dance gives the music a whole other layer, and dance, even the most simple, more gestural things that is kind of postmodern, I guess, feels so powerful and feels so emotional. I mean, I remember working on the choreography for the show and showing my neck, like almost offering my neck to the audience.
Yeah.
And the first time I did it, even in rehearsal, It felt so vulnerable, and you know, depending on what kind of person you are and how you move, like you carry a lot of stuff in your body. You carry all of your life and trauma and all that stuff just in there. So the releasing of that through a movement that you don't normally do is like, I mean, I cried the first time I did that. It was really like, something really. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, dance's movement is so powerful, and dance has become just one of my favorite things to watch. ¶¶
graceful motion she sat down slowly, drank a cup of coffee and she'll fall on me. She begins to tell us all her life story. All around the table, everybody's staring. Who shouts out hallelujah? Who's gonna sing?
Another first. We just mentioned him, David Byrne. We should talk about the first. What were your first impressions of him?
Oh, he was lovely. I had seen him at shows a couple times. I'd seen him at like a Joanna Newsom show. I'd seen him around, you know, the Bowery Ballroom, and then the first I heard that he had come to one of my shows at the Bowery Ballroom, and that was just. It was one of those things where I wished my friend had told me after the show that he was there, but she saw him and she rushed up right before the show and was like, David Byrne is here. And it's like, great, now I'm going to choke. But incidentally, the same thing happened with Prince once. I was like, please just tell me after. Tell me after that Prince was here. But then I met him at a charity event and he came up and he said he really liked my actor at a work video. And he was just so nice and... He was lovely. I mean, and he continues to be just one of the loveliest in the world.
Let's do another first. The first jazz artist that you fell in love with, because you've name checked Miles Davis, Coltrane, and
I mean, I remember I had a boom box that sort of was a karaoke machine, and I would sing along to "Lady in Satin," the Billie Holiday record, and just try and copy all the riffs and stuff.
I'm a fool to want you. I'm a fool to want you. To want a love that can't be true. A love that's there still, I'm a fool.
There are a couple of things. There's always like Oliver Nelson's Blues in the Abstract Truth, which is like, that just, I, that's such a beautiful record. You know, I mean, to be like 15 and hearing like Coltrane's A Love Supreme, that was shattering. I mean, truly like shattering, like, oh, okay, this is some like monastic transcendence. This is some trip he's on that's like blows the heavens apart kind of thing. So that from any kind of like music, the kind of whatever technical side of things, who cares? I didn't understand, you know, it wasn't a question of like understanding it, but I understood a level of the emotional resonance that was like, oh, this just shattered me. So, you know, stuff like that.
We'll be right back. When you became, it's not the right word, but kind of when you became famous, I guess, you know, how did it feel to kind of to have the spotlight burn that much brighter towards you? Because it's a very interesting, I mean, fame is often more fascinating to people that aren't famous than people that are or have been. And it's a kind of strange, it's that dichotomy again. Half of you kind of thinks, God, it must be a bind, it must be really difficult. And the other part of you thinks, yeah, but you get free stuff and amazing seats in restaurants. And which I guess that's how it appears from the outside.
Yeah, I mean...
I'm simplifying here, but you know?
No. But I think that you're... I will say that I'm only just at the point where I get a table at a restaurant.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. But also, I'm not... But it's never... To me, it's unclear to me whether it's because the maitre d' or the, you know, host, like, heard my record and liked it, or if I'm just really, like, friendly, and they're like, well, we'll go ahead. So it's unclear. I can't even say for sure if it's a byproduct of somebody liking the music. I have no idea. Unless it's explicit, like, here's an appetizer. Thank you for this record. I'm like, sick. I love tostadas. Whatever. You know what I mean? Like, that's so cool. I'm that kind of, like, generosity. So nice. I'm. It's always surprising and shocking and flattering to me. But
sorry,
it's on. Like how honest do you want me to be? There's a lot of different sides to it, right? I mean,
yeah.
Because everyone's a person, and everyone in some ways deals with who they actually are, and then a projection of who they are. Like every single person on earth deals with that kind of dichotomy, and it's just a little bit more intense in the line of work I'm in between the person and the projection of the person. And also, like, what is, like, the fact that somebody, that this music that I've worked really hard on and, you know, believe in gets out into the world and then people love it, and some people hate it, which is great too. Like, no, really, truly, like, who cares? It's who cares? It's great. The fact that like doing something that I love gets out into the world, and other people can love it or hate it or take it into their lives, and it might mean something to somebody, and then somebody saying as much, that's wonderful. Like, that's, I've been a fan of music my whole life. I've been on every side of the equation of it. I'm just so lucky that I get to give back to this tradition of music and everything that music's given me over my entire life. Like music, like the fact that I sat in a room as a kid and obsessed over records and got pretty good at you know, moving my fingers over some steel and wood means that I've met my heroes. It means that I've seen the world. It means that I've met wonderful people and had, like, these communal experiences with people in a live setting. That's incredible. That side of it, that is unbelievable. It's truly unbelievable. The tending to the projections.
Mm.
If it's not about, like, oh, really making something and kind of getting to dig in on the creative side, then that's, you know, it's effort, but whatever. It's a small price to pay for getting to do the thing I love.
You love. So far in a few blocks to be so low. And if I call you from First Avenue, we're the only other sucker in the city who can handle me. New love wasn't true love, back to you, love. So much for a home run with some blue bloods. If I sucker in the city who can stand me, I have long. So if I trade out for some Hollywood, we're the only other sucker in the city who would. Only other sucker in the city who would. Only other sucker in the city who forgive me. I have lost a hero, I have lost a friend, but for you, darling, I'd do it all again. I have lost a hero, I have lost a friend, but for you, darling, I'd do it all again.
That audience performer bond is really, it's really special. And I mean, I'm a fan of bands like Lightning Bolt, who set up in the middle of a basement and there's no separation between the artist and the audience. And I mean, I believe that to be true on a human and psychic level. Obviously, everybody's just a human being coming to a space, trying to go somewhere else together. But I mean, fortunately, the places that I play need to have stages, so that's, you know, that's not an indicator of some sort of like idea of audience and then other. It's like, you know, that's anyway. But it's just, yeah, you're entering almost into a social contract. Yeah,
especially if it's just you on stage.
Yeah, well, I'm done with the solo show now, but yeah, that was. You know, I was telling my drummer, Matt Johnson, actually, I was telling him, looking back on it and realizing, oh, I made a decision at some point that I was going to go on stage in front of thousands of people alone. I don't know why I made that decision.
Why did you make that decision?
I have no idea. I truly don't know. I mean, I thought that it was the best way to present the thing that I wanted to present, and it was more like a theater show than like a rock show exactly, but... Mm. But it was only after the fact that I kind of went, yeah, I went on stage and performed alone for 6,000 people. Why? Why did I do that? Who knows? A lot of these things are mysteries to even the people who decide to do them.
Final thing we ask, I guess, is you get to pick the last song we play at the end of the show. Anything you want.
You know what? Why don't you play the first track of the Mayhem record? You know, the one that's just like drums?
Why that
song? It's really sick. Because the drums are sick.
That's a good enough reason to play a song.
Yeah, you'll find it. The first track is like starts with drums and it's awesome. A drum solo.
Let's end with a drum solo. Annie, it's been lovely to speak to you. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, you as well. Thank you very much. And I'll see you guys soon.
Music.
This is
Six Music. Technique.